I'm delighted to introduce Helen Beebe from Birmingham, also an honorary at the Centre for Time there, who's going to be speaking to us on the question, how well has Hume's psychology of causation withstood the test of time?
Helen. Thank you. Okay, so this talk comes with two warnings. The first is that it's kind of not really a philosophy talk, it's not really a history of philosophy talk, and it's not a psychology talk either. It's a kind of hideous amalgam of the three, which may offend purists in the audience. You may want to look away. The second warning is Hume is many people's favourite philosopher. Unfortunately, the Hume that they have in mind when they think that he's their favourite philosopher differs quite significantly from person to person. The Hume who's my favourite philosopher may not be the Hume who's any of your favourite philosophers, and you may be offended by that as well. I'm going to make some quite controversial interpretive claims about what Hume's doing, which you may want to take issue with. Feel free. Okay, so how well has Hume's psychology of causation withstood the test of time? The basic idea of the essay, of the talk, is going to be we should kind of think of Hume primarily as a psychologist about causation, not as a philosopher. And I'm kind of going to take that for granted a little bit. So I'm partly going to explain what I think Hume's psychological story about causation is, what kind of psychological mechanism he thinks generates causal perception and inference. And then I'm going to talk about some issues that are kind of live in the contemporary psychological debate about causation. And can you hear me all right? Okay. And just kind of say something about where the contemporary debate stands relative to the kind of view that Hume had on this. And the claim isn't going to be that Hume got everything right, but it's kind of going to be, at least in some respects, he wasn't too far off the money, which is pretty impressive, seeing as he was, you know, writing before psychology was even invented. So the things I'm going to talk about are causal perception, causal inference and associative learning, the connection between causal inference and causal perception, and finally, the place where I think that there's kind of a big problem for Hume, which is the issue of innateness. Okay, so here's my first controversial interpretive claim. I think that Hume was much more interested in the psychology of causation than he was in the semantics and metaphysics. The interpretive debate about Hume's views on causation is quite heated, and there's a huge divergence of views about what Hume thought we were doing when we make causal claims and what, as it were, causation in the objects is. So you get on the metaphysics side, you get some people saying Hume clearly thinks that all causation in the objects is just regular there's just regular succession out there, whereas you get other people like Galen Strawson and John Wright saying, no, Hume thoroughly believed in intrinsic necessary connections between events. So massively different on the metaphysics side. On the semantic side, you get similar differences. You get people saying, no, Hume, all Hume thinks causation is regular succession, right? A causes B just means A's are constantly conjoined with B's. You then get the kind of view that Simon Blackburn has proposed, and I've kind of fleshed out in a couple of places, which is a kind of non-cognitivist sort of view. So the idea is that we project the idea of causation onto regular succession, and so when we make causal claims, the idea of necessary connection is part of the meaning of those claims, even though all there is in the world is regular succession. And then you get the skeptical realist people who say, no, Hume thinks that the idea of necessary connection really latches onto some intrinsic relationship between causes and effects. So massive disagreement there. And that's kind of puzzling, right? I mean, you might think, especially seeing as Hume is supposed to be held up as sort of the model of clarity when it comes to philosophical writing, you might think, how is it that despite the fact that he's supposed to be a model of clarity, he couldn't even manage to state his view in a way that distinguishes between kind of regularity theory and skeptical realism? That's just really peculiar. Various reasons you might think that that's so. One reason might be that, you know, Hume's just not sensitive to some of the distinctions that you need to deploy in order for that debate to make sense about non-cognitivism or reference, those sorts of things. I think maybe a better explanation of why it's so hard to pin him down on the semantic and metaphysical questions is that he's just not very interested in the semantic and metaphysical questions. I think the question he's interested in is a psychological question about how it is that we get to infer effects from causes, come to causal judgments, and come to see the world as a world of causes and effects. And there's an awful lot less room for interpretive dispute on that score. He's, you know, if you think of him as a psychologist of causation, here's the claim, he's really got quite a clear view. I'm sure there is room for some interpretive debate there, but seeing as this is an issue that people have not focused on very much, there sort of hasn't been particularly an interpretive debate about it. But I suspect that were there to be one, it would be quite a constrained debate. It wouldn't have anything like the kind of radical differences that you get in the debate about the semantics and metaphysics. So I think when Hume says at the beginning of the treatise that what he's doing is the science of man, he's applying the experimental method to humans, to moral subjects, we should take him at his word. That's exactly what he's doing, by and large. So in the case of causation, what he's doing is he's doing the psychology of causation and not the metaphysics and the semantics. I'm slightly over-egging things here because I think that Hume takes his story about the psychology of causation to serve an epistemological agenda. So it's the epistemological agenda that he really cares about, and he thinks that he needs, wrongly, as I'll explain later, he thinks that he needs a certain kind of psychological story in order to underpin that epistemological claim. And the epistemological claim is basically no a priori access to the causal structure of reality, right? So when you look at previous philosophers, particularly philosophers who are keen to prove the existence of God from a priori principles, they typically wheel out a priori causal principles. So in Descartes' trademark argument, you get the a priori principle that's manifest by the natural light, that the cause has at least as much reality in it as the effect, or is supposed to be just a priori, known a priori. In the cosmological argument, you get, again, an a priori principle that every event has a cause, and so on. So we can think of Hume's target here as the claim that there's no a priori, sorry, the claim that he wants to establish is that a priori knowledge of the causal structure of the world is impossible, and he thinks that he needs to have a certain kind of psychological story in order for that claim to be justified. I think he's wrong that he thinks he needs that story, but anyway. Okay, so I want to kind of outline what I think Hume's psychological story about causation is. Now, here's the question that I think Hume is starting out with. We'll get to causation a bit later. At the moment, I'm going to say something about inductive inference. Here's the question I think he's interested in. How is it that we get to have beliefs about the world? Now, Hume has a very restricted notion of belief. So when I say belief here, I basically mean expectations or predictions, right? So not beliefs about what's in front of my eyes. Hume just thinks of those as impressions. Not beliefs that I'm kind of dredging up from memory. Similarly, they're kind of just on the impression side. And also not knowledge. Hume's already, when he asks this question, when he does what I think is asking this question, he's already given us an account of how it is that we get knowledge of the world, right? So you have impressions, you get ideas that are less vivid versions of those impressions, and once you've got ideas, you get to have knowledge when you put ideas together in such a way that you realize that they, you can't conceive of the ideas not standing together in that way. So when you compare the idea of two and the idea of four under the less than relation, you just kind of intuit that they couldn't possibly fail to stand in that relation, and then you end up with an item of knowledge, viz. Two is less than four, right? So that's an item of knowledge. So he's got a story about how it is that we come by knowledge. We haven't really got a story about how we come by impressions, but, you know, intuitively you might think that they come from contact with the external world, but he doesn't want to say that. So he's specifically interested in how it is we get to have beliefs. We come into the world with none of this stuff, you know, blank slate. We get all these impressions, we form ideas from them, we end up being able to formulate certain items of knowledge, but now what about my belief that it's sunny outside, or my belief that Hugh's still going to be sitting there in 5 minutes' time, or my belief I'm not going to float up to the ceiling, or whatever. How is it that we get to have beliefs? And he's interested here in not specific beliefs, but how is it that we get to have any beliefs at all about the external world? How is it that any beliefs get into our head when we start out without any? Now, what kind of question is that? Well, what he needs to do in order to answer that is to find a psychological mechanism which delivers belief as output but doesn't have belief as input, right? We want to explain how it is that anybody can ever get to have any beliefs whatsoever. And the mechanism that's going to do that is going to have to be a mechanism that doesn't have any beliefs as input, right? Otherwise, we're going to end up just going in a circle. What's the input to the mechanism going to have to be? Well, it can't be belief, right? Otherwise, that's not going to be the mechanism that does the job Hume needs. So it's going to have to be some combination of impressions, ideas, and knowledge, because we've already got a story about how it is that we get to have those inside our heads. watch the mechanism. The mechanism is custom or habit, or what I'm going to call the A mechanism, which is short for associative mechanism. So that's the mechanism, but I just want to say something about how it is that Hume thinks that this mechanism works, and in particular something about how he thinks we don't get to have beliefs about the world. This is where I might start offending some people. So consider the following argument. This will be familiar to most people in the room. When Hume's talking about inference from causes, reasoning from causes to effects, a claim that he considers and dismisses is that the way that we get to end up with an expectation, for example, the expectation that some event E will occur, is that we run the following argument. Look, I have a present impression of C, so I know that C occurs. C's have been constantly conjoined with E's in my past experience. Here's the uniformity principle. This is why I call this UP. Instances which I haven't experienced resemble those I have experienced. Therefore, event E will occur. Right, now, standard story about what's going on here is that what Hume's interested in is the justification of inductive inference. How can it be that I'm justified in believing that E occurs? And then what's wrong with this argument is that it's circular, because in order to use this argument as a justification for the conclusion, I must already be justified in believing premise 3, but of course I can't be justified in believing premise 3 unless inductive inference in general is justified, which is just what this argument is supposed to do, right? So it's circular in a justificatory sense. I want to say that's not Hume's interest at all in this argument. Remember that his question is, how is it that we get to have any beliefs at all about the world? Question: can this schema explain how it is we get to have any beliefs? Well, the mechanism is fine. The mechanism is just deductive inference, and that's a perfectly good mechanism for generating beliefs. So no problem with the mechanism. No problem with P1. That's just a present impression. No problem with P2. That's just an item of memory. Big problem with P3. P3 can't be known a priori. Take your idea of the past and your idea of the future. Put them in the resemblance relation. Ask yourself, is it conceivable that the past doesn't resemble the future? Answer, obviously, yes, that is conceivable, right? So P3 can't be an item of a priori knowledge. Only other thing it can be is a belief, right? So this can't be an explanatory story about how belief is possible, right? It can't be a story about what the mechanism is that takes us from a situation where we have no beliefs to a situation where we have beliefs. Why not? Well, because it's a mechanism that requires belief as input, right? So there's an explanatory circularity going on here. What Hume needs is a mechanism that doesn't have any beliefs as input. So, okay, so that's the problem with it. What's his positive story? Well, it's a very simplistic one. Here's the way things work. You have a present impression as of C occurring. You infer that E will occur. What's the input to that mechanism? It's a present impression. The billiard ball striking the other billiard ball. What's the output? It's a belief. What's the mechanism? Custom or habit? And the caveat here is that the mechanism is only going to be activated when past C's have been conjoined constantly in my experience with past E's. So it's a kind of a memory constraint. Now, you could think of what I'm thinking of as a kind of background condition. You could just think of that as an input, that's fine. I'm kind of not wanting to think of it as an input because I want to make the point that the fact that past C's have been constantly conjoined with E's in your experience doesn't have to be something that you're consciously entertaining in order to draw the inference. So Hume has this line about the man going down to the water and feels afraid without having to think at all about it. You know, he doesn't have to consider the fact that, you know, in the past people who've fallen into the water have drowned. That's just kind of completely automatic reaction, right? So that, as it were, consciously, the only thing that he's got before his mind is the impression of the water, and so that's generating the expectation that he'll drown if he falls in. But he doesn't need to consciously wonder about whether he's got the past constant conjunction, right? It just has to be the case that, in fact, there is the past constant conjunction lodged in his head. So, as I say, we can think of that as an input, but it's not something that has to be consciously entertained. This is a good explanation of how it is we get to have beliefs, right? The input to the mechanism are a present impression and the memory. The output is a belief. The mechanism is custom or habit. This is kind of a black box explanation, obviously. He's not going to tell us exactly how this mechanism works, because he's not a neuroscientist, he doesn't know. But he's kind of telling you what the input is and what the output is in a way that's not explanatorily circular. So I claim this is what Hume's doing when he's talking about inductive inference. He's not at all interested in the problem of induction. He's interested in the psychological mechanism by which beliefs get to be formed. Okay, so far what the A mechanism is doing is generating expectations, right? Given past experience and a present impression, I end up kind of automatically and instinctively with an expectation about what's going to happen next. I want to claim that Hume also takes the A mechanism to generate causal perception and not merely expectation, but causal inference, inferences to judgments about the causal features of the world. So here's my Hume quote. This is the only Hume quote you're going to get. I need to put it under the light. But when one particular species of events has always in all instances been conjoined with another, we make no longer any scruple of foretelling one upon the appearance of the other and of employing that reasoning which can alone assure us of any matter of fact or existence. That's just the expectation bit. We then call the one object cause, the other effect. We suppose that there's some connection in the one by which it infallibly produces the other and operates with the greatest certainty and strongest necessity. It appears then that this idea of necessary connection among events arises from a number of similar instances which occur on the constant conjunction of these events, but there's nothing in the number of instances different from every single instance which is supposed to be exactly similar, except only that after a repetition of similar instances, the mind is carried by habit upon the appearance of one event to expect its usual attendant and to believe that it will exist. This connection, therefore, which we feel in the mind, this customary transition of the imagination from one object to its usual attendant, is the sentiment or impression from which we form the idea of power or necessary connection. Now, I want to make, I think, two interpretively controversial claims at this point. The first is, I claim that, on Hume's view, the impression of necessary connection gives us genuine causal experience. So when Hume says all events seem entirely loose and separate, and people take that as evidence that Hume thinks that we don't have genuinely causal experience, they forget that Hume's explicitly talking there about single instances of the operation of bodies, which to say cases where the A mechanism has not had a chance to get going yet. Right? So my claim is that once your A mechanism's up and running and you've got constant conjunction there and you've got the inferential mechanism going, what happens is that inferential mechanism generates the impression of necessary connection, and that modifies the nature of your visual experience. Right? So you really do see one billiard ball causing the other billiard ball to move. Right? That's part of your experience. Now, of course, you're not, in the philosopher's sense, you're not perceiving one ball causing the other ball to move, because, of course, well, okay, sorry, this bit's controversial. No, actually, it's not controversial. Nobody thinks that Hume thinks that we can perceive any kind of objective mind-independent connection between them, right? So in a philosopher's sense, this isn't causal perception. But in the psychologist's sense, this is causal perception. As far as psychologists are concerned, causal perception is a matter of, I don't know, if you like, seeing things as causal. It's measured by whether people, when you ask people to report what they see, this is one way of measuring it, whether they give you an answer in causal terms. And I claim that Hume, does think that we perceive causation in that psychologist's sense of perception, right? So it's not detection, but it's genuine visual experience that has causation as its content. Now, as I said, I'm not going to argue for that. I've, in fact, argued for that in this very room a while ago. So I'm not going to do it again. You're just going to have to take my word for it. The second claim, again, interpretively controversial claim I want to make, but I feel extremely confident about this one as well, that for Hume, causal judgment involves the idea of necessary connection. So when you say A causes B, you're not simply saying that A's are always followed by B's. You're effectively saying that A's are necessarily connected to B's. Whatever the metaphysical or semantic implications of that might be, that is what you're saying, at least part of what you're saying. So that gives us two more things for the A mechanism to do. So the first thing that it does is it generates expectations, the expectation that the ball will move. The second thing it does is that it generates causal perception. We see the first ball's movement as causing the second ball's movement. And third, I didn't really explain this bit, we also end up with a causal judgment. We call the first event cause and the second the effect, right? So on the basis of our experience, and the inference that generates that experience, we come to judge that the movement of the first ball caused the second ball to move. Right? So all of those three things are done by that mechanism. Oh, and I just wanted to give you the... Because we have such nice round biscuits. This is Yuma Schott. causal experience thing. Just ignore my arms and look at the biscuits. Ready? How did that look? That's supposed to look like the first thing made the second thing go, right? That's what you're supposed to think. I don't think Michotte did it with biscuits. Right, so that's your A mechanism. Oh, here's my nice picture of the A mechanism. Well, maybe not so nice, kind of complicated. So here's the way it goes. We've got the input to the mechanism is past experience of constant conjunction plus a present impression of your ability, ball moving or whatever it is. Feed that into the mechanism, which is habit or custom. Now, two things get generated by the mechanism. On the one hand, we have the expectation that the second billiard ball will move, and also the transition of the mind from the input to the expectation delivers us the impression of necessary connection. That impression of necessary connection then gets us to the causal perception of C causing E. And then you put the idea that we form on the basis of that impression together with the expectation, and you get the judgment that C caused E, right? That's the mechanism. Hume, I take it, thinks that dogs and pigeons have the habit, so they certainly get the expectation. I'm pretty sure he doesn't think they get to have any judgments coming out of this. I don't think he states a view on whether they have causal impressions. So anyway, other animals have the habit. It's just that they might not have all of the kind of baggage that comes out of it. So might not generate quite the same sorts of things. Alison's talk this morning might make you worry about some aspects of this already. So for example, it looks as though some of the experiments she was talking about tell us that in some cases, like with your two-year-olds, when you don't have the hand, the habits generate the associative learning is generating the expectation, but it's not generating a corresponding causal judgment. Whereas when you stick the hand in, it does get to deliver the causal judgment. And that's kind of going to be a bit worrying for Hume, right? Because as far as Hume's concerned, there's no interesting difference between seeing something move and bash something else and seeing something move by a hand and bashing something else. So that's going to be a worry. But anyway, let's set that aside. Okay, so that's the A mechanism. Now, all of that was causation considered as a natural relation. Have I been given half an hour already? Okay. I'm not going to say anything about the natural philosophical relation distinction in that case, except to say that Hume makes this distinction between natural and philosophical relations. I think that distinction, again, is a psychological distinction about the mechanism by which beliefs are formed, the mechanism by which ideas kind of pop into our heads and are compared together. Hume thinks that causation is both a natural and a philosophical relation. Natural relations are the relations that have, as it were, associative principles underlying them. So that's the A mechanism when it comes to causation. He also thinks that causation is a philosophical relation. That means that he thinks that we can, as it were, take two ideas and compare them under the relation of causation. So I might wonder whether drinking coffee is a cause of keeping me awake, for example. I might not have a view about that. There might be no inferential mechanism established. It's a question that I might wonder about, and I might come to a conclusion on the basis of what people tell me or some evidence that I manage to remember or whatever. And this generates another mechanism. Hume doesn't talk about this as a mechanism. He's thinking of this as, he's not thinking of inference in this case as a kind of psychological mechanism. He's thinking of it as kind of conscious deriving stuff. And I'm calling this the C mechanism to flag the fact that this is kind of conscious causal inference. This is something that requires quite a lot more cognitive ability than the A mechanism does. And the idea is just that we can reason about causation, right? I mean, we're not just, unlike dogs, we're not just stuck with that primitive associative mechanism. We have a way of reasoning about causes and effects. So, for example, I'm thinking about actually Toby's kind of story about the natural history of chance hypothesis, of chance. Toby, when he was talking about the pigeons pecking at the food source, and you get 80% if you 80% of the time if you peck this one and 20% of the time if you peck that one. And Toby's story was that kind of generates, there's a very sort of primitive mechanism there that generates generates a chance hypothesis, which is what your pigeons and your rats have got. And now there's a more cognitively sophisticated mechanism that human beings deploy, which in this case, unfortunately, leads them to get less food, but in most cases is probably quite a good thing. And in your pecking case, what might be going on is that people are reasoning, and this is very much in line with the kind of thing that Hume would want to say, We start from a kind of an assumption of determinism. We see that some of the time we get the food and some of the time we don't when we press the lever. Similarly with this one, there must be some underlying mechanism by which some of the time we get it and some of the time we don't. So most likely what's going on here is there's just some mechanism that's set up so that there's some pattern. And if only we could discern what the pattern was, we'd get food 100% of the time, right? So this is all deterministic. So maybe you have to do, you know, A-A-A-A-B, A-A-A-B, whatever, and then we'll get the food 100% of the time. And that doesn't work, so you try some other pattern. That doesn't work either. So you end up getting less food. So it's a similar sort of thought. That there's this kind of the one sort of immediate instinctive mechanism that we share with other animals, and then there's a more cognitively sophisticated mechanism that we don't share with other animals. So, for example, and I'm mentioning this particular case because I'm going to say a little bit about this kind of case later, there's a sort of what psychologists call backward blocking, where you draw inferences about what it is that some event C causes, using evidence that doesn't involve C itself, right? So there's no associative mechanism has been set up here, or at least that's what it looks like. So, for example, apart from giving the last talk, I tend to feel very drowsy in the last talk of a conference when it's not me giving it. I might wonder about how best to keep myself awake, and I think, well, gosh, in the past, whenever I've had coffee and cake before the last talk, I've felt pretty wide awake. When I've just had the cake and no coffee, I felt incredibly sleepy. What can I infer from that? Well, here's a plausible hypothesis. It's the coffee that's causing me to be wide awake, so if I want to stay awake, I better have some coffee. That's not the only hypothesis one might reasonably come to, but it's certainly not an implausible one. Now, there I've come to a causal conclusion on the basis of no associative learning about coffee by itself at all. I have no experience of just drinking coffee by itself without the cake. So, and here's how that kind of bit of reasoning might go. Look, every event's got a cause. Hume thinks that that's an empirically established claim. Clearly the cause isn't cake, so it must be the coffee, right? So the thought is that Hume has another mechanism here for explaining how it is that we can get causal belief that isn't a kind of a brute associative mechanism. So, and what's the connection between the mechanism? Well, between the mechanisms, only beings with the associative mechanism can have the conscious mechanism, because without the associative mechanism, you don't get to have any beliefs about the world whatsoever, right? Remember the inductive inference. How is it that we end up with any beliefs whatsoever? It must be through custom or habit. In addition, if you don't have the associative mechanism, you're not going to have the impression of necessary connection, so you're not going to have the idea of necessary connection, so you're not even going to be in a position to make causal claims, even if you could somehow have expectations. So the C mechanism depends upon the A mechanism, but you could have the A mechanism without the C mechanism, and I take it that that's how Hume thinks things are with dogs. So that's the psychological story. Here are the, just kind of rehearsing the consequences. There is such a thing as causal perception. There are two mechanisms responsible for causal inference. One of them is kind of instinctive immediate and kind of animal. The other requires some extra cognitive ability. I'll come back to this claim a little bit later. Hume's in a position to be able to say that causal perception is sometimes separable from causal inference, and that's because we have two distinct mechanisms that will generate causal inference, and only one of them generates causal perception. And clearly he thinks that neither causal perception nor inference is innate, in the sense that if you don't have the past experience, you don't get to do anything at all. No expectations, no causal judgments, no causal experience, nothing. Because you need past experience of regularity. Right, okay, that's the view. So now thinking about how well that view ties on to kind of contemporary psychology, and I'm quite ignorant of contemporary psychology, so I hope that doesn't cause too many problems. So this is kind of just what I've managed to discern, and again, I just want to stress my claim is not, wow, Hume gets everything right. It's kind of, he didn't do that badly, considering. So thinking about perception of causation, as I've said, I think Hume thinks there is such a thing as causal perception in the psychologist's sense. This comes as a surprise to philosophers because when they quote the claim that all events seem entirely loose and separate, they forget the surrounding context, according to which Hume is just talking about single instances of the operation of bodies. It will surprise psychologists, I take it as well, for one thing, because the way that Michaud, when he was doing his experiments in the 1940s, explicitly took himself to be showing that Hume was wrong in saying that there's no causal impression, which is kind of odd because Hume says there is a causal impression. It's just not an impression of sensation. As is a standard view in psychology, I have a quote from David Danks in his contribution to the excellent Oxford Handbook of Causation, edited by me and Peter Menzies and Chris Hitchcock. David Danks says, causal perception has traditionally been viewed as philosophically interesting because it seems to be a partial psychological vindication of Kant over Hume. Certain judgments of causality seem to be part and parcel of perception rather than something that occurs after basic perception has taken place. And I want to say that's exactly Hume's view. It is part and parcel of perception and not something that occurs after basic perception has taken place. Okay. And as I've said, there's an ambiguity in perception here. So in one sense, psychologists are right to think that Hume thinks we can't perceive causation, right? In a philosophical sense, he doesn't think we're detecting anything, but in psychologist sense, he thinks we do perceive causation. As far as I can tell from the psychological literature, Hume seems to have got this bit right. Psychologists, by and large, seem to, I think probably not all of them, but by and large, they seem to agree that there is such a thing as causal perception, right? It's not just that we infer causation on the basis of more basic experience, we really do perceive things as causal. Hume got that right, I want to say. So that's not to say that Hume got everything right when it came to perception of causation. I think he got that question right. Do we perceive causation? But he might not have been right about the mechanism by which we perceive causation. And in particular, Hume does subscribe to the claim that causal perception is dependent upon the operation of the A mechanism, right? So it's incredibly tightly connected to causal inference. You're going to get the causal perception just when the A mechanism is also delivering up an expectation and also a judgment that C caused E. Now, is Hume right about the connection between causal inference and causal perception? Well, very hard to get evidence here. Alison said something very similar to this earlier on. Here's Rebecca Sachs and Susan Carey. By the time experimentalists can find robust evidence of causal perception, inference have already had 6 months of experience observing causal interaction. So it's very hard to get an answer to the question, could you get any causal perception if you didn't have any background learning that was, as it were, generating that perception? Like Hume thinks you need the background learning in order to generate the perception. Is that true? Who knows? I think maybe they've got it down to 4 months now. I'm not sure. I'm pretty young, but still quite a lot of experience. Yeah, Hume's view is still kind of in the running on this. It might turn out not to be right, and I'll come back to the issue of innateness later on. So next up, causal inference and associative learning. The associative mechanism is this kind of crude Pavlovian thing. Nonetheless, it looks like most psychologists agree that associative learning plays some role in causal inference. May or may not be the whole story. Now, there are various ways in which it might fail to be the whole story, and Alison gave us a way in which it might fail to be part of the whole story. But there's one sense in which it might not be the whole story, which is entirely consonant with Hume's view. So here we've got the Blickett detector again. This is a case of backward blocking. So your Blickett's are things that make the music play. It's kind of like a pad thing you put the block on. Does the music play or not? If it makes the music play, it's a Blickett, and if it doesn't, it's not. So in the first case, you put both the blocks on and the music plays. When you just put A on alone, the music plays. Second case, put them both on, the music plays. And then you put A on by itself and the music doesn't play. Now here's the question asked to four-year-olds. Is B a Blickett? And what you get is different answers to those two questions, right? You tend to get a no for the first question and a yes for the second question. Or actually, it's a bit more complicated than that. But anyway, you get different answers. And the point here is that this is four-year-olds making causal inferences, right? I mean, you're asking a causal question when you ask whether something's a Blickett. You're asking, does it make something happen? And there's no evidence one way or the other in the sense that they've never seen block B just go on by itself to see what happens, right? So they're drawing inferences on the basis of no actual past experience of that particular, what happens when you do that particular thing. Now, again, Hume does have an additional mechanism for causal inference here. Association isn't the only route to causal inference. So it's not that Hume has to be completely troubled by this sort of case, or at least not prima facie. We've got the C mechanism here. That's going to generate causal inference even in the absence of associative learning. So he's not claiming that associative learning is the whole story. Okay, next up, causal inference and causal perception. There's a question here about what the connection is between those two things. So again, David Danks in that chapter makes the point that this is quite an underexplored area in psychology, and there are lots of different ways in which causal inference and perception might be related. They might be the same mechanism, they might be distinct mechanisms, one might be a subset of the other, one might be necessary for the other, and so on. And as he says, one way to try and answer that question is to try and find situations that prompt only causal perception or only causal inference. And that would seem to suggest that we've got two different mechanisms because they're being, you know, you can activate one without activating the other. So here's one experiment that seems to get that result. I'm oversimplifying massively, but basically what Schlottman and Shanks do is they get, it's kind of a computer simulation thing, you get your kind of Michot type launch events. So you've got something, you know, bashing into something else and the second thing moves. And also you have colour change. And it turns out, after you've seen this a bunch of times, you can figure out that actually there's no correlation whatsoever between the launching event and the second thing moving. But there is a correlation between the first thing changing colour and the second thing moving. I think that's the way it works. And what people end up saying is, oh, yeah, so they make a causal judgment, a negative causal judgment, which is that the launching doesn't cause the second thing to move, but they still report that it looks like they do, right? So you get the causal perception, it looks like this thing's causing this thing, but that's dissociated from the judgment because they judge that actually the first thing isn't a cause of the second thing. Now, again, I want to claim that that's compatible with Hume's view, at least if you kind of play a little bit fast and loose with the whole constant conjunction story. So you might think, all right, strictly speaking, Hume's wrong to think that you need absolutely inviolable 100% correlation in the past in order to draw the inference. Maybe you just need to have kind of like massively dominant regular association for the inference mechanism to kick in. So in your experience taken as a whole over the course of your life, one thing bashing into another thing which is movable has typically followed by the second thing moving off, right? This happens just overwhelmingly. Now you're stuck in front of a computer and it kind of fails to happen a few times. That's just not going to stop the associative mechanism working. It's going to work anyway. So what that's going to deliver is causal perception. Now, of course, it's also going to deliver inference as well, but that inference is going to be immediately overridden by the other mechanism coming in and saying, oh, no, hang on. That can't be a cause of that because I can tell that these things are not constantly conjoined, right? And there's some other cause that is constantly conjoined with it, which you know, even though I'm kind of not seeing it, I can easily tell that it's the colour change that's the cause and not the launching, right? So you can get an explanation there of how it could be that causal perception and causal inference come apart. You've got the irresistible mechanism that's generating the perception. It's also generating an inference that then gets kind of immediately overridden by your more sophisticated mechanism. But, of course, it can't override the causal perception because you've already had the perception, right? It's too late. You can't kind of undo what you've seen. Okay. The last thing I want to talk a little bit about is innateness. So, question about whether some aspects of causal perception inference might be innate is a major challenge to Hume. Again, as I said, the jury's out on this, so it's not obvious that this is all going to kind of refute him. But it could be that some causal perception inference is innate. So, for example, maybe you don't need past experience of constant conjunction to get some causal perception. Again, you get your 6 months old and they differentially treat these kinds of cases. Causal, right? And these kinds of cases. Not causal. Right, so maybe that's just a kind of an innate thing that we've got. I mean, not you don't need to have the past experience to kick the mechanism in, right? Maybe it's kind of like preloaded with certain kinds of particularly salient sorts of combinations of events that we're already kind of programmed to judge as causal, or to see as causal, sorry. Maybe some kinds of causal inference are innate, and this is going to be more of a problem for Hume, I'm going to say. Maybe we are born with some assumptions about the causal structure of the world, and that's going to be a problem for Hume, because if we have anything that remotely looks like a belief or an assumption that involves causal content, then it's going to turn out that it can't be that the associative mechanism is generating the idea of necessary connection, right? Because it turns out that that's going to be inbuilt. On the other hand, this is kind of making excuses for Hume now. Hume's scruples about innateness are based on his epistemological group was about rationalism, and I claim, for fairly simplistic reasons, he's just kind of wrong about that. So in fact, Hume could accept some innateness when it comes to causal perception and inference, without weakening his arguments against causal rationalism. And maybe he should have done that, but it's kind of not really his fault, because he was just, you know, this is just what people thought at the time. Okay, so the thought is that although if he turns out to be wrong about innateness, he's wrong about innateness, it's not kind of like a huge wild departure from Hume's kind of psychology, and certainly doesn't affect his epistemology, were he to give up on the kind of empiricist psychology, at least some of it, and kind of go a little way towards innateness. So why do I say that he's wrong? Well, here's Hume's thesis, I claim. A priori knowledge of the causal structure of the world is impossible. We can't know a priori that every event has a cause. We can't know a priori that there's at least as much reality in the cause as there is in the effect, whatever that means, and so on and so on. Standard early modern view was that innateness generates a priori knowledge, right? So if belief that P is innate, then P is known a priori. That was just the standard view, I take it. Given that view, supposing that view was true, Hume would need to hold that causal inference and so perception is acquired and not innate, right? Because if it was innate, that would be a priori knowledge. But of course, he doesn't need to think that causal inference and perception are acquired and not innate, because he's just confusing, as other people did, the genesis of belief with the justification for belief. So, for example, it might be that you can learn P through experience and yet it still be true that P is knowable a priori because its justification is a priori. So I'm pretty sure I learned that 1 plus 2 is 3 by counting marbles and Lego bricks and so on. So I wasn't born with the knowledge that 1 plus 2 is 3. That doesn't at all contradict the claim that 1 plus 2 is 3 is a piece of a priori knowledge, right? Even though it was learned through experience and even though I wasn't born with the concepts 1, 2 or 3. Similarly, or corresponding, going in the other direction, seems perfectly plausible that you could have an innate belief or something, similar to a belief, and yet that P, and yet P be justifiable only a posteriori, right? So even if we're born with some assumptions about the causal structure of the universe, that doesn't make it knowable a priori that the universe has that structure, right? It could still turn out that those beliefs are simply false, right? And it's an empirical question whether those beliefs are false or not. Okay, so again, so you can have, in principle, you could have, as it were, an innate psychology without having a sort of a rationalist epistemology to go with it. And that's the distinction that I'm claiming that Hume just kind of doesn't see. So just to kind of try and make the point that he's kind of in... The idea that some of this stuff might be innate isn't kind of completely anathema to Hume's kind of overall point of view. Here's a quote, I think, from the Inquiry. As this operation of the mind by which we infer like effects from like causes and vice versa is so essential to the subsistence of all human creatures, it's not probable that it could be trusted to the fallacious deductions of our reason, which is slow in its operations, appears not in any degree during the first years of infancy, he might be wrong about that bit, and at best is in every age and period of human life extremely liable to error and mistake. It's more conformable to the ordinary wisdom of nature to secure so necessary an act of the mind by some instinct or mechanical tendency which may be infallible in its operations, may discover itself at the first appearance of life and thought, and may be independent of all the laboured deductions of the understanding. So now, if some kind of ability to infer like effects from like causes were innate, which is to say, as it were, the kind of the expectations are pre-programmed and not derived from past experience, that would be even more conformable to the wisdom of nature, right? Hume's saying, it's a really, really good thing that we have this mechanism because it enables us to go around making the kinds of predictions about nature that sustain our very existence. It would probably be an even better mechanism for sustaining our existence if, as it were, we didn't have to have the past experience before the mechanism got to work, right? It would be even better for us. We'd be even more likely to kind of survive and get through things without making terribly wrong predictions. So, although, as I say, if the idea of causation was innate, so if we were born with assumptions about causal structure rather than just pre-programmed expectations, that would kind of be problematic for him. So I was kind of wanting to say that the idea that we, as it were, have pre-programmed to have certain kinds of expectations, that's entirely consonant with Hume's account, but the thought that we might actually have pre-programmed kind of beliefs about causal structure, that's more of a worry, right? Because Hume's whole story is that the idea of necessary connection only pops out once all of this stuff has kind of got going. Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, you need the mechanism to operate before you can get the idea of necessary connection. Okay, so here's my conclusion. Hume, he was writing more than 250 years ago. Psychology hadn't been invented. His method was terrible. It was terrible. It was introspection. That's all he had. He had no kind of precursors for any of this, you know, just nothing. He just kind of invented it all for himself. He really did quite a good job. I mean, he's certainly not right about all of it, but he did quite a lot of it not too badly. He seems to have been right about causal perception. He's at least partly right about the role of associative learning. He's at least partly right, I want to say, about the relationship between causal inference and perception. Might be wrong about innateness, but, you know. That's really not too bad. And indeed, even if he's kind of wrong about all of this stuff, the very fact that you can give what I think is quite a plausible story about what Hume's psychology is and kind of even talk in the way that I've been talking about how this maps onto kind of the contemporary psychological debates, I think in itself is quite a significant fact about Hume, right? He's kind of talking the language that makes sense from the perspective of contemporary psychology, and that's really quite an extraordinary thing for someone to have done in the 1740s. So it's a kind of like a, this talk is a kind of like, yay, Hume, but maybe it's the psychologists who should be saying, yay, Hume, and not so much the philosophers that should be saying that. Thank you.
Yeah, so this is right back at the beginning, and just a kind of boring exegetical question.
Okay.
So just I'm clear. So Hume's got this thing with induction, and it's traditionally presented, it's an epistemological problem. You've got to justify the thing, and justify it a priori or a posteriori. Well, it's not a priori, and if you try to do it a posteriori, you're just assuming that which is to be proved. So that's a traditional interpretation.
Right, yeah.
You say, no.
Yeah.
It's a different sort of argument. It's a psychological claim. It's where do we get this belief from? And you can't get it from other beliefs. And the problem with adopting the principle of uniformity and opposite is that's just another belief.
Right.
So it's an interesting proposal, and this is the perspective which is a boring question. You know this stuff better time. And that just doesn't seem to be argument what happens. I mean, if memory serves, I mean, Hume, if memory serves, he seems to be verbatim that sort of, not verbatim, but that sort of epistemological argument that I just sketched. It says, look, it's a relation of ideas, or it's a relation of whatever the other one is, impressions, and can't be this one, and if it's that one, then you're begging the question, and so this thing can't be justified. I mean, this is just going, is that a correct impression of the text, and if so, are there other aspects of the text that tell in favor of your?
Yes, so, I can't say enough to kind of do it fully justice. So all of that was fine, except for that it can't be justified. But oh, so one thing to say is that a lot of the interpretive issues about Hume, and this is kind of one of them, sort of depend upon whether you like the treatise or the inquiry. So he sounds kind of a lot more epistemological in the inquiry than he does in the treatise, and I'm kind of going with the treatise here. But I think there's nothing in the inquiry that really decisively comes down on the kind of epistemic interpretation of it. So everything you said was fine until you got to the bit about justified, right? So there is a sense in which he's accusing that kind of uniformity principle argument of being circular. I mean, he really is doing that, but the circularity is a kind of explanatory circularity and not a justificatory circularity, right? This is not a mechanism that it could explain how it is we get beliefs and why not. Well, it's because we've already had to presuppose some belief to get the mechanism up and running, right? I can't quote any stuff to you, but he doesn't talk in terms of justification. He talks in terms of whether it's, you know, is this a priori reasoning or is it a matter of fact that requires kind of empirical reasoning.
If I may follow up briefly, if it was a psychological argument, why would he have to talk about the a priori stuff at all? Why would it need to be a two-point dilemma?
Oh, because if it was an item of knowledge, then the mechanism would be absolutely fine, because he's already given us a story about how it is we acquire items of knowledge. But it turns out the uniformity principle doesn't fit that account.
So it's saying it's not a priori, it's saying it's not.
It's not knowledge, right. Right, right. So the problem with it's not being a prior knowledge is not that casts doubt on its justificatory status. It's that stops it being a bit of input that it would be perfectly okay to stick in. Right, that's the thought.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in both, and I think this is actually the really big, perhaps the only big difference between contemporary psychology and cognitive science and Locke and Hume and Berkeley and all of what I think of as being the psychologists of the 17th and 18th century. You know this, but sociologically, there's no particular reason to think of him as being a philosopher.
Right.
I mean, in fact, there's no reason to think of him as being a philosopher rather than a psychologist any more than there is to think of any of the scientists of the period as being philosophers because they had thought, said that what they were doing was natural philosophy. But what he did, the only things that he really didn't have were he didn't have the idea that you could have unconscious psychological entities. So everything, the ideas, the impressions, the it's not just that for him the conscious inference part is conscious, but for him the ideas and impressions that are getting associated by custom and habit are conscious too. And I think that is a big, I mean, I think that's one really
right.
big reason why he couldn't have gotten to things like causal inference mechanisms or causal structure actually being there innately. And then, of course, the other thing that he doesn't have is he doesn't have evolution. So
right. yeah.
I think when you, it's sort of fascinating. A lot of his resistance, and I think you're absolutely right, I think a lot of the reason why he resists things like representationalism, which seem to us as cognitive scientists sort of, you know, perfectly straightforward. Why would you rather have this dumb, now, there still are a lot of cognitive scientists who like dumb mechanisms, but, you know, they're dumb as opposed to Hume, who obviously isn't dumb. Why would Hume rather have a dumb mechanism? And it's, yeah, I think it's because the only way that you can see that the representational kind of account can work is if it's a priori, and he doesn't want it exactly as you say, he doesn't see any kind of mechanism that you could have that would get
right.
representations except the mind of God, which is, you know, if you don't have a mechanism like evolution, it is pretty hard to see what kind of representation you could have. And the fact that everybody around him is saying, yeah, and there is a mechanism which is God sort of reinforces that. So I think it's sort of interesting if you're trying to think about what, you know, if you think about Hume plus unconscious mental entities and evolution, you'd end up with something that did look a lot like contemporary.
Yeah, so just going backwards with those, I agree with almost all of that. So the big kind of quote that I gave you at the end about the wisdom of nature was in a way kind of trying to point towards the thought that he'd be so receptive to a kind of evolutionary explanation of what was going on, right? It wasn't available to him, but it's the sort of thing that he absolutely was in a position to accept because he has this idea that, gosh, we've been set up in such a way that allows us to get through life without things going terribly wrong. It's just that the only thing he's allowing himself is the kind of the associative mechanism. That's kind of like the only thing that we're born with. It's just that it's, you know, so we have a certain kind of facility. It's just that it doesn't give us any concrete expectations. It's just a kind of a facility. I guess on the conscious thing, I mean, you're right about, I mean, the what I'm calling the C mechanism for Hume is that's a fully conscious mechanism, right? The associative mechanism, I take it, is not, it's unconscious in the sense that, I mean, that was why I kind of made that kind of caveat about the input, right? So the only thing that needs to consciously be before your mind is the impression of the cause, that's it. So that's kind of pretty unconscious, right? You don't need to be consciously remembering the past experience. I mean, somehow it has to be in your head, but you don't have to be consciously remembering the past experience. It's just going to kick in even if that's kind of not accessible to your conscious mind. So there's some unconscious stuff there, but it's only with the associative thing. It's
but
not
the
with
the experiences are all conscious, right?
So oh yeah, no, okay, yeah, no, that's true.
Peter, did you have my finger?
Yeah. This might be a glass half full, glass half empty sort of point about what he had and what he didn't have. But to me, it seems relevant here that a really big thing he didn't have was a trial and error picture, a mechanism based on a trial and error pattern rather than what you refer to as a kind of Pavlovian or classical conditioning or pattern. So he didn't have anything like a law of effects, didn't have anything like that in reinforced learning. And to me that seems sort of huge. And connected to Alison's second point. So of course, when Darwin comes along and introduces an evolutionary picture, that is in its own way a kind of trial and error model. So I guess I think of Hume as someone who suffered substantially from not seeing that. And, you know, this is very speculative, but one thing you might say
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. That's a nice thought. Yeah. So that, I mean, you know, he could do trial and error reasoning, but it's all going to have to be conscious stuff, right? It's not. That's all going to have to be the C mechanism stuff. That's going to have to be, oh gosh, well, this thing followed that, and then why did it, what appeared to be exactly the same thing, and nothing followed it, and now I kind of wheel out some fairly sophisticated causal reasoning to get to the conclusion that there must be some difference in the alleged cause. And but yeah, this is not.
It's not doing that much, I take it, with the idea of experiment and then see what happens. You know, toss out the Skinner type picture, toss things out, see what happens. Keep the stuff that works, throw away the stuff that doesn't. That's something which I think someone like Hume could have, in some sense, gone for.
Yeah. Didn't. Yeah, no, that's right.
How's the finger on?
Yeah, so this is a finger on this, but I actually think the Newton point is really interesting, because one of the things that happens is because Hume's so crazy about Newton, he doesn't pay attention to people like Boyle. So you sort of think, suppose Hume had been reading Boyle instead of reading Newton, he would have had a notion of experiment, because part of the difference in the sort of philosophy of science,
right,
because, you know, Newton has this really weird philosophy of science where even when he does an experiment, he shuts up about it and acts as if it's just, it's a little part of the deduction that I had to stick in, and the only way I could do it was actually by doing an experiment. But he doesn't have any sense that going out and doing trials of nature is actually the way that you could get knowledge. And I've wondered whether if Hume had been paying more attention to,
right,
people in science and philosophy of science who were kind of glorifying experimental technique as opposed to Newton, who of all the scientists, you know, of all the great scientists, really disses experimental technique, really downplays it, really wants it all to just be a matter of one idea is kind of naturally leading to another in an axiomatic way. I wonder if that might be part of it. And
yeah.
The other finger on this is that it is, I think it's interesting that Hume, I think, not disingenuously says the only reason that he can think of for justifying God is the argument for design. So it's as if he's, you know, he recognizes design, and he recognizes,
yeah,
well, that's actually a place that he thinks that the argument to some kind of divine, you know, being would make sense, which I think is also relevant to sort of, you know, he kind of has a sense that if somebody had come up to him with evolution, he'd say, oh, shit, right, that's what.
So that's a nice point about the argument from design, and I mean I haven't thought nearly enough about Hume on religion, but I mean a plausible reason why the design argument might be the only one that he'd kind of really take seriously is that's a kind of a piece of empirical reasoning, right?
Yeah.
I mean, perfectly sensible causal principles get you to the thought that we must have, you know, there must be something that kind of fixed things so that they work in this amazing way, right? Whereas the other arguments of the existence of God all appeal to these very dubious kind of a priori principles. I was going to say something else. Oh, yeah, just so about the experiment stuff. So when I said he did pretty well considering he had a terrible method, your point is he's sort of culpable for that, actually. I mean, it wasn't like that wasn't in the air. It's just that he was sort of too fixated and not on Newton and not fixated enough on, you know, Boyle and maybe Bacon and people like that, right?
Yeah, but I think it's also that he didn't kind of have a model for his model. I mean, aside from the fact that he wasn't doing experiments himself, that then his sort of epistemological model, because it's so much based on the way that someone like him could get knowledge about the world, I think there's sort of an implicit sense that here's a model of how you could really do a wonderful job of getting knowledge about the world and science, and he just isn't paying attention to all the people he could have been paying attention to, who would, for instance,
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah.
Just a finger on that. Isn't there something that's slightly unfair to Hume about putting it that way? Because if you think of him as a skeptic about induction, then he's got a reason for not basing everything on the Baconian method, which somebody who's not worried about induction hasn't got.
Yeah, that's not a response I would want to give, because I think he's not a skeptic about induction,
yeah,
but
no,
I can see how that, yeah.
I realise it's sensitive to that sort of
thing. Yeah, no, I can see how that would work. I mean, I get, you know, I'm inclined to take him at his word when he says he's doing the science of man. He takes himself to be doing something that isn't then going to be undermined by his own findings about the, you know, the irrationality of inductive inference, right? So I guess I'm kind of more with Alison on this, that it's, he could have... That's something he could have... I mean, it's just a very odd thing to say, I'm doing the science of man, and oh, and by the way, in the process of doing this, I'm going to completely undermine my own conclusions.
Oh, but then if you have these two different conceptions of how we think about science, which seems to be what was at issue here, whether a Newtonian one or the sort of Baconian body.
Okay. Oh, so somehow his method would be not susceptible to inductive scepticism, but a more experimental...
Maybe less susceptible.
That was what I meant. Yeah, so his method would be... Okay. I mean, I'd have to think about that. If he is a sceptic about induction, he's such a hardcore sceptic. I think he isn't, but if he was, I mean, he'd be such a hardcore one. That would be a very difficult line for him to tread, that somehow... I mean, having established that... absolutely any expectation whatsoever is completely unjustified, it would be kind of odd for him to then go, my psychological theory, however, is pretty predictably good.
But I just thought that there might be some sort of middle position here which didn't require him to be a really hardline sceptic in that sense, but it nevertheless provided at least some sort of explanation why...
being a bit hostile to kind of experimental.
He wasn't inclined to sort of be a kind of... a sort of empirical foundationalist in that sense.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Okay, Peter.
Actually, one of the points that Thomas has made has been taken on by Alison and Peter was the point about the observational fact that his account of inference is so observational that it doesn't actually allow any room for experimentation. And this is something which is continued. And it's known that there are certain kinds of cases where if you're just looking at kind of observability frequencies, you can't actually distinguish sort of distinct causal structures. So if you have A causes B causes C, that has the same kind of relative frequency, observed frequency relations as B causes A and C. So if you're just kind of using observed empirical so frequencies, you can't actually distinguish those causal structures. You have to use interventions or experiments to actually intervene. I wasn't entirely sure about Hugh's point. It seems to me the skepticism about induction is going to apply equally extrapolating from an observed sample as to extrapolating from an experimental sample. It seems as though kind of inductive skepticism is going to apply equally to observational studies. But the other point I wanted to make was a point about sort of about Hume scholarship. There was an inference in your early on in your paper where you said Hume says that we have an impression of a necessary connection, therefore we have a perception of causation. And I was sort of puzzled by that because I thought that the standard view was the impression we have of this necessary connection is a sort of impression or reflection that we get from reflecting on the transition in our mind from the belief of the presence of the cause to the belief of the presence of the effect. So that's a kind of impression or reflection. And surely in order to have a perception of some causal relation, you'd have to have a sense impression rather than impression or reflection. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that transition from the existence of a sort of impression or reflection to the perception of causation.
Yeah, so the first thing to say is that the term impression of reflection isn't supposed to indicate that somehow this is something that we have to kind of think about, right? I mean, it's a kind of, it's an automatic, I mean, just as kind of, you can be made very angry by something. It's not like you have to think about, gosh, that was a really mean thing to do. Really think about it, and then you get angry. No, you just get angry. And it's a similar kind of thing, right? It's a kind of automatic, instinctive thing. So So the thought was just, the sense in which, when psychologists say that we have causal perception, they're not making the metaphysical claim that there's some intrinsic relation between causes and effects such that we detect it, right? I take it that's no part of the psychologist's claim. All they're saying is that stuff looks causal to us, the ball seemed to make the other ball go, that kind of thing, right? Our experience has some causal content, I guess that's the way of putting it, right? But now our experience, that's neutral between the claim that it has the causal content because we're directly reacting to some feature of the external world and the claim that it has that content because the mind is sticking some extra stuff in. I mean, I guess you think about kind of colour perception or something, right? That we have colour perception, right? But that's not to say that we're responding to some kind of intrinsic, reddishness of things, right? I mean, the mind's doing an awful, putting a lot of stuff in there when we perceive redness. So I take it that, so my claim is that Hume's, the analogy with colour perception isn't that great, but it's just that distinction, right? That in the psychological sense of causal perception, Hume thinks that we have causal perception. In the philosopher's sense of causal perception, Hume clearly thinks that we don't have causal perception, because nobody thinks that Hume thinks that we actually detect, even people who think that Hume thinks there are necessary connections, they don't think that Hume thinks that we detect them. So we don't have causal perception in that sense, but in the psychological sense, we do have it. That was the claim. Does that make sense?
I
mean, we're bringing something into the table here when we have our causal perception, but that's consistent with
the... No, I think that in the philosopher's sense of perception, it's a kind of success term, so if you perceive a certain state of affairs, the state of affairs must obtain, and I understand the psychological conception of perception abstracts from that kind of success, that success connotation.
Yeah.
But even so, in the psychological sense of perception, when you perceive the situation, when you perceive the causal relation, presumably, this must be a response to a singular instance.
Yeah.
But the problem about the impression of a necessary connection is that it's always based on experience of a whole bunch of different instances. So it just looks as though the kind of impression of a necessary connection isn't going to lead to the perception, which should be of a single instance.
Why not? So the expectation that's generated is an expectation about a single instance, right? This ball moves, I expect that ball to move. The mind is drawing an inference here at the very same time. What that inference does is create an impression, not a sensory one, but an impression of affection. And that impression is somehow or other, now there's a big story here, but somehow or other that impression is kind of bundled up with the sensory impressions to deliver a kind of an experience, which is an experience as of one thing causing another. That's the idea. Okay.
Yes, the more you say, the more you talk, the more I'm persuaded.
All right, okay, good.
Is there anyone feeling less persuaded than people? I can raise another question. Yes.
It's possible to pull up the model.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I just want to ask about synthetic between the branching parts.
Okay.
You've got two parts, so are they intended to be simultaneous, or is it?
Oh, yeah, so, I mean, none of this is stuff that Hume really says something about.
I'm assuming the diagram is some representation of your opinion. Is that correct?
Sorry?
This is a representation of your opinion more or less now, is that what you're going to say?
It's a representation of what? Sorry?
Your opinion?
Yeah.
Okay, so
my opinion of what Hume thinks.
Right, sorry. So, I'm assuming that at the branch point, is one occurring before the other, at least simultaneously occurring in a human agent, or...? After habit, we branch an expectation and impression. Is that simultaneous? So are we processing these, so to speak, simultaneously?
So this would all be saying things that Hume doesn't say anything about in a way that makes it seem plausible, but I guess the thought would... So when you see one thing causing another... I mean, there are lots of aspects of Hume that just make, I mean, whatever your view about what he thinks about the impression of necessary connection, what's going to make it very difficult to fit into his kind of ideas and impressions model, right? Because any experience as of one thing causing another is kind of going to have some duration to it, right? Because the cause is going to happen before the effect. Whereas the generation of the expectation had better happen before the effect occurs, right? Otherwise, it's not going to be an expectation.
Let's assume that this isn't a subject seeing a UFO. Let's assume it's someone watching billiard balls.
Right.
So they can run it again and again. So we start with the impression, oh, look, there's a coloured round object falling across the green. Oh, it knocked into another object. At that point, having seen that, then the modelling that is occurring internally then produces the expectation, which is then verified on the next instance. Is that...
Oh, no, it's happening on this particular... Right, so I've got the habit of association all fixed up. I've watched lots of games of billiards before, and now I see the black ball moving across... the white moving across the table. I can't remember if billiards has white and blacks. Anyway, see the ball moving across the table. It makes contact with the black. that's the point at which I'm going to form the expectation that the black's going to move, and it does. So the expectation's kind of getting there on this particular trial, as it were, and before the effect actually happens, I take it that's the idea. And somehow the impression that is also generated kind of at the same time, in the sense that the same mechanism is producing it, is we then have this kind of temporally extended kind of causal experience as of one thing causing another. I mean, I'm making all this up, obviously.
The second thing I want to ask was, when we're watching conscious agents behaving, did Hume have anything to say, like, tie it up like this? Did he have anything to say about our ability to infer motive? I use cowboy films as a sort of wacky example. We often see in cowboy films terrible things happening, and we discover in retrospect that it was justified because the person who copped it really was awful, and that kind of thing. Was that ever touched upon?
Not specifically when he's talking. I mean, he just doesn't make it. He doesn't. I think, to all intents and purposes, he just treats human agents as other kinds of kind of complex things where there might be hidden mechanisms at work, right? So, yeah, sure, we can infer motives on the basis of behaviour, but that's not going to be a kind of automatic associative thing. That's going to be a kind of conscious reasoning thing, right? There must be a cause to this thing. What could it possibly be? I can't observe it, so it must be something inside. And I guess maybe you could do some analogical reasoning from your own case or something like that. None of that's going to be kind of instinctive stuff.
Sorry, the last one would be when information is lacking. So if we're talking about shadows, and if we're talking about the information is incomplete, or our impressions are being perturbed by conditions that are internal or external, is this something that he touched upon? So the inability to have a closed model, having a model which was more fragmentary and which relied upon real active participation in making assumptions about outcomes.
I'm not quite sure I'm getting what the point is. You wouldn't just. So this is just a crude associative mechanism, right? Whatever you've seen before, that's what you're going to expect to happen again. It kind of goes back to some stuff that Alison was talking about. I mean, all the kind of more cognitively sophisticated stuff than mere association for Hume is happening with the other, what I'm calling mechanism, but which is a kind of conscious inference sort of thing, right? So there's no kind of nice. So, 2-year-olds engaging in kind of proper causal reasoning, I think kind of Hume would be sort of worried about, because he's assuming that the conscious mechanism is kind of like way more sophisticated than that.
So it's still much lower level.
Sorry?
It's still much lower level.
This mechanism is all really crude association stuff, and then there's the conscious stuff, and you can do some pretty sophisticated stuff with the conscious reasoning, but it's all conscious. Yeah.
That's fine.
Helen, just opinion again. It does occur to me that there's something that you could easily do to this model, which would make it a little bit more general in cases. For example, we're dealing with cases in which C and E are pretty much, they're very closely connected in time. I feel there isn't time to get an expectation in there.
Right.
But you could always put something very similar to the expectation in the future. So, but something which shows up as absence of surprise. So
right.
The feeling, oh yes, that was normal.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
What,
okay.
That's
yeah.
That's what I would have expected, and contrast it to the feeling of surprise.
Yeah. I mean, again, that's that Hume himself can't do that, right? Because this has all got to be impressions, and they've all got and ideas, and they've all got to be before the mind, and
an absence of
surprise isn't it's not a belief. It's a. But yeah. So if you wanted to kind of.
Well, think of absence of surprise as a kind of symptom of this thing, which you're going to think of as the putting expectation into the past tense.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, yeah. So if you kind of wanted to seriously if you wanted to do stuff to this model that would make it seem like a better model than what it actually is, that's one kind of move that you could make. But as with many aspects of it, it's not a move that Hume himself, I think, is in a position to make, just because he's just operating with the very crude impressions, ideas. These things have to be before the mind. It's all got to be conscious, kind of thing.
Oh, I didn't think of my thing as intention with consciousness.
Oh, I was thinking like it would be
is in a sense friendly to that.
Oh, okay.
Because one of the problems with the very quick cases is there doesn't seem to be time for anything conscious to get in. But if you generalize the notion so that expectation is sufficiently general, so that it's kind of reflecting on what you just saw, you think yes, that it kind of in a reflective way you think yes, that's what I expected. As it were.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So it was supposed to be Hume friendly in that sense, dealing with some of these problems about the timing of the whole thing.
So I have the do I have the expectation consciously, or
expectation is not the right term because it's not future directed, but what you have consciously is, as it were, thinking. You feel yes, that's one way to put it in language is say yes, that's what I expected.
Right.
But there's a feeling there, which is the one that you express in those words.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I'll think about that.
Alison. Yes.
Yeah. So that just to follow up on that, that would be a way that you could get to the perception, that you could get the expectation and the perception to work the same way. And actually,
right.
It's funny because that's exactly what happens in the infancy case. So in the infancy case, one of the arguments, so all of these studies all depend on this looking time effect, where the babies look longer at the thing that's actually unexpected, and the debate is, it seems as if that could just come from the associative mechanisms, right? So that could just be the result of prediction. But it's interesting that the data is in fact exactly not the baby, as it were, really making a prediction or really being surprised. It's not that the baby's, you know, looking forward and saying this will happen.
Oh,
it's
right.
The baby sees it,
it's
and kind of
going.
The baby's reaction is
right.
Either look longer or don't look longer, sort of in the way that you're suggesting.
That's nice. Right. Okay.
In the back of my mind.
Okay. Right. Yeah. No, I like that. Yeah. Thanks.
And that just comes from I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm wondering about. Because you want the perception to actually have the necessary connection. I mean, a sort of human take would be to say that just comes from the expectations. You just get it for free from the expectations that you have this extra bit of phenomenology.
Right. Yeah.
When you see the thing that's expected or not expected.
Right, because the phenomenology just is the phenomenology of the mechanism working, right? So
right.
Whenever the mechanism, I mean, unless you're kind of really cognitively deficient and just don't have the impression for some reason, you're
and
always going to get it.
Translate that somehow into necessary, when the fact you've got that phenomenology of, yeah, this is what I expected, you translate that into necessary consequence talk.
Right,
Tibor, another finger on this?
Yeah, another finger. I remember hearing something at a conference or a lecture that I went to. Cognitive science, that there's actually some evidence that this comparing of the expectation with the perception does take place,
okay.
And it plays a role in identifying the actual thing that happens. One of the ways if I say want to move my hand, then I have this expectation that I'll see my hand move. I then see my hand move, and the perception of that is compared to my expectation, and that gives me a sense of identity. That's how I know it's my hand.
Right.
Because, I expected that to happen. And there are problems with people with lesions in the brain and so on, where if part of that system's broken and they don't compare, they think the hand moving isn't their hand. There's identity issues with failing to compare the expectation with what you actually perceive. So I think that comparison actually does take place.
Oh, okay.
There's some evidence for that.
So that could be exactly the sort of like kind of a cognitive malfunction where the transition of the mind is not generating the appropriate impression. Right, okay.
Or the
comparison
is failing, or the comparison is actually not being made,
right.
Or the expectation is not being generated, but you see something and you're not expecting it. So I think that actually internally goes on. It's all subconscious, you're not aware of any of this. You don't have to consciously make that happen. But it all happens in part of your generation of the perception of what's going on. So it's actually closer to the fact than we think. Hume's actually doing better. If he does that, he's actually doing better than we think.
Okay, cool, right, thank you.
Okay, last question, Macaulay.
Okay, two little questions. First one, was that a quote? Was that a modernized bit of Hume?
Which, what?
This,
hear that last pony hand about nature.
No, that was Hume. That was real Hume.
I thought the phrase was, yeah, nature had no doubt deemed it too important, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
That wasn't in your... Anyway, so it doesn't matter.
It might be the ode. Yeah, I can't remember whether that's from the Inquiry or the Treatise, and it might be that he says slightly different things in each one, and I'm giving you one, and I don't know. There is another quote actually, which was the quote I was looking for, and I couldn't find it, and I ended up with that one. So you might be thinking of that one.
my question really is about how we should be understanding Hume. And, you know, there's no doubt that these thinkers of the past were doing all sorts of things all at the same time. And in lots of ways, I think Hume is an example in point of someone whose arguments and ideas outstrip his program. In lots of ways, what's attractive about the treatise is that the arguments taking places that were actually inconsistent with what he says earlier on. And the arguments are so powerful and attractive that he never sticks them in there. And some of the things he drops, like the stuff on miracles and so on, you think, well, really that wasn't attached at all, was it? It was just that you discovered that argument and you're going to throw it in anyway. So in one way, I like the idea that you can see what Hume is doing is making these really important contributions to psychology, which didn't then exist, or the science of man as he describes it. But the question is whether we shouldn't see him as also making really significant contributions to philosophy. And in particular, when you emphasise something that you actually said was about the connection between the genesis of judgments and their justification. Once you put that on the table as well, it's not just that you've got this mechanism. You've got this background doctrines about what would count as justification. And I was wanting your view about whether that brings him back into the table of philosophers and what you think he thought about that connection with respect to his own theory.
I'm kind of inclined to think that, okay, so he's got this epistemological target, right, which is rationalism.
I think he's also taking empiricism as well.
He clearly thinks that some empiricists have, got various things wrong, right? As far as justification is concerned, I don't think he is very interested. I think part of the problem with the whole problem of induction is that he doesn't give a story about why inductive inference I think he clearly thinks that inductive inference is justified. He just doesn't express skepticism. For one thing, he never expresses skepticism about causal claims, right? And whatever your interpretation of Hume, if you think he's a skeptic about induction, he's going to be a skeptic about the existence of, or at least the continuation of causation, right? Doesn't express any skepticism about that. And it's kind of unfortunate, given the way that he's been interpreted when it comes to induction, that he just doesn't really say anything about justification. He kind of calls inductive inference a kind of a just form of reasoning at various points, but he kind of never really says why, except insofar as he's got this line about our minds kind of going along in train with the order of nature. So you can kind of think of it as a sort of proto-reliabilist justification, but that's kind of all you've got, really. It's a priori knowledge, that's all fine, and that's all to do with inconceivability, so, no problem there. Empirical knowledge, I think he just kind of thinks, look, it's just obvious that causal reasoning, good. Education in the kind of bad sense of sort of rote learning, bad. Witness, and now you've got all the stuff about miracles and unreliable witnesses and stuff, which is all kind of premised on the kind of causal inductive stuff. I think he just takes it for granted that causal reasoning is absolutely fine. Not infallible, but absolutely fine. And there are various other forms of empirical reasoning that are terrible. Why is that? Well, the reason they're terrible is because they're not based on causal reasoning. So that's kind of his story. Causal reasoning, good. Anything that you can't fit into that model that's empirical reasoning, bad. Why is causal reasoning good? I don't know. But does that sort of answer the question?
Not sure. My take of his view about matters of fact is that he's got a very strict notion of what would justify a matter of fact, and that is an appropriate impression, and that where that's lacking, you need some sort of other story. So I think that there's two parts to his attack on to accounts as causation, for example. There's the attack on the rationalists about what's conceivable and what isn't. There's also an attack on the empiricist story as well, where he wants to show that there's no appropriate impression that will give us the now non-relation of ideas judgment, which would be the causal judgment. So I guess I'm still at a loss to see whether you think that makes him into a philosopher as well as a psychologist or not, or whether you think that he's not concerned. I think he is concerned, and that he does have a view about justification, a very clear view about justification. He thinks he's got some sort of story to tell that we might not find plausible now.
Right, okay.
But that is about... what's natural.
Okay, all right. Yeah, so maybe he's more of an epistemologist than I'm making him out to be, and I'd be happy. I mean, I don't kind of like... I have an axe to grind here. Like, it's not like I want to show that we shouldn't think of Hume as a philosopher at all. Clearly, he was quite a good philosopher in many ways. It's just that the... insofar as he is doing philosophy, he's more interested in the epistemology than he is in the... metaphysics and the semantics, and the psychology is kind of driving the epistemology. I mean, that's kind of... So the psychology is kind of really central to the project in a way that the semantics and the metaphysics just kind of aren't really very central to the project, I don't think, because they don't affect the epistemological stuff very much. Does that make sense?
Okay, we're out of time. Thank you, Helen.